This episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe is sponsored by the Black Arts Matter Network, blackartsmatter.net. Welcome to the Energy Stoners Cafe. My name is Toni Quest, and I'm really happy that you're here. I like to interview the most interesting people I can find on the planet. So grab a cup of coffee, sit down, relax, and listen. You're going to find that these guests are so intriguing, you'll wonder why you didn't know about them before. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe. Thank you so much for tuning in. And once again, I have one of the most interesting people on the planet. This week, we have a wonderful musician and songwriter. Her name is Paula Atherton. She's actually a jazz saxophonist, as well as a flautist. And I think you play clarinet as well. Am I right about that?
I'm a clarinet owner.
Okay. She's a clarinet owner, but she's definitely a saxophone player because I've heard her on a number of occasions. I was very fortunate to have her be the background music for a gig I did on my own for a party I had some years ago. And I still enjoy hearing her and seeing her. Right now, she has embarked upon another album of her work, and I believe it's called Can You Feel It? And it's lighting up the airways. So her name is Paula Atherton, and she's here. Thank you, Paula, for being on the show. Now you can correct everything I said. But
thanks for having me, and you're doing great.
Thank you. So tell me about your new album, and then I'll talk about your past.
So I did have a good amount of the album finished when COVID hit. And then when that happened, I had a lot of concert festival dates booked for the rest of the year, but I knew that those were all going to be canceled. So then it was like, well, I guess I'm getting the rest of the album done now.
So you found that you just sort of fueled your creative juices. A lot of us are doing that, because you can't do what you were doing before. So it's a good time to generate ideas and music. Tell us about your new album.
I'm really excited about it. I think it's a really fun record. And the people that have gotten it so far and have listened to it have told me that they really like it. As a matter of fact, my good friend Hap Carpenter had a visitor the other day, Ray White, who has a radio show. And they called me on the phone to tell me that they think that this album is my best yet.
Oh.
That made my day.
I can imagine, yes.
Yeah, it's my sixth album, so it means a lot to an artist, a songwriter, that people, it like your music. It's like if you're a mother and you have kids and people say, oh, your children are so cute and well-behaved. Well, I don't have kids, but I got these albums.
You got these albums. Those are your children, right?
And my instruments, you know, and my dog maybe, but yeah, that's what I got.
Yeah, so you actually record most of your music in a home studio? Like, where do you do most of your recordings?
I'm sorry that my dog is joining in.
That's okay. We like dogs. It's okay.
So on this album, I actually had five different producers. And so what happened with that, the first single that was released was the title track, Can You Feel It? And it got released in January. And it went to number one on Billboard for 3 weeks.
Wow.
Billboard, the Smooth Jazz Network, and Media Base. It was number one on all of them. Number one for 4 weeks on the Smooth Jazz Network and 3 weeks on Billboard. And that was my very first number one on Billboard. So I was going crazy because, you know, I was quarantined.
Oh, wow.
All my shows were canceled. And I mean, I was so thrilled about it, but there was nothing I could do about it.
I know, it's hard. It's been a tough time. So you're talking about things I've heard from a few performing artists about how the COVID like lockdown, even though I don't like to use those words, but it feels like it actually made your business as an artist come to a grinding halt.
Yeah, you know, I had heard about the virus, and February of this year was like a really busy month. I had four road trips. I was in two cities in Texas, Iowa, And then February 29th, I had a show in Chicago at a theater. It was sold out. It was a really nice show. I had a 10-piece band. I had backup singers and a horn section. And I came home March 1st. And I was supposed to leave on the 13th, I think, because I had a show on March 14th in Colorado Springs. And I think on the 12th or the 13th, it must have been the 12th, the owner of the venue sent me an email and he said, "Don't you think we should postpone your show, seeing that people are dying from this virus?" And I read it a few times. I'm like, wait a minute. It wasn't...
The wording is a little off.
Well, yeah, it was strange wording, but I was like, really dying? I mean, in the beginning, I just thought it was going to be like a flu type of thing, because COVID, you know, the common cold is actually a COVID virus, you know?
Yes.
It wasn't really clear to me how deep this thing was going to be. And that's when it started to hit me. And then one by one, all my local work, corporate work, and then all my festivals one at a time folded. And I started to get the gist of...
Yeah, what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a rough one, but you know, you do have the propensity to actually make the recording. Do you find that within yourself, do you feel it within yourself that you may be able to kind of do a little bit of a shift in terms of how you present your work and get your work out there? I mean, creating an album during the pause seems like the most logical thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was going to get it done this year anyway, so I just got it done a little bit quicker. I started to tell you that I had five different producers on this. And so as far as the recording goes, my end of the recording, I do hear.
Right.
But for instance, the first single, Can You Feel It, was co-written by Greg Manning. Greg and I wrote it together. He produced it. He lives in California. So he works on the track. He sends it over. I work on it. I send it back to him, that sort of thing. So that went on quite a bit. He also wrote and produced my second single, Just Can't Stop, which is out now. Summer Song, I wrote, but Nate Mitchell produced the track for it. In the Pocket, I co-wrote with Matt Godina and my husband Lou Jimenez. And Ain't No Denying was actually the first song that I started to work on with Paul Brown, who's had a lot of number one hits. And he's in California also. So he came up with the track and I wrote the melody. Actually, he co-wrote the melody on that too. We actually had a couple other co-writers on that one. And Funculator, Skylar Deal, my good friend Skylar Deal, actually wrote that and produced the track. And he's in the United States. He's in Pennsylvania.
I think it's wonderful that you're giving, you know, credit that's due to the people that you've collaborated with, you know, because, you know, a lot of times people forget to do that. I think that's really good. And so these people that you work with, you're kind of working remotely and coming out with one cohesive product. I find that really fascinating. And I also see that it seems musicians are the ones that you see doing it the most. It fascinates me how musicians always find a way to work together.
Musicians have done that throughout all time, even when, you know, prejudice was at its height and, you know, white and black musicians couldn't really work together or weren't allowed to in the way that they wanted to. Musicians always work together. Musicians, it's like a different kind of language that we have. And, you know, we don't really care about any kind of like prejudice against anybody. We just work together. We spread love and, you know, we spread through our music. We spread love to people and happiness. And that's what we do.
Well, music is the thing, in my opinion, which I don't always offer, but my opinion is I think music is the thing that sort of draws us all together, no matter which way you look at it. You know how it is they say when people get together, you know, it's like the music that you have in common that allows you to stay in the same room without fighting. This is you can quote me. I just feel that way. And I think it's interesting that you were able to come up with this album and collaborate with so many different musicians to make it happen.
Yeah, well, I wanted, since this is my sixth album, you know, each time I try to change up stuff a little bit. So, I mean, I can write the whole album myself. I'm the main writer of most of my stuff, but I wanted to collaborate more with different people on this just to get, you know, different flavors and a different take on things. And, you know, I don't want people to get bored with my releases, with my music, you know.
So let me ask you a question. How long, I have actually two questions, is I want to ask you like how you got into jazz, because it seems like jazz is like all in you. And what were you trying to actually communicate in particular with this album? Because, you know, you are an outstanding musician. I've heard you play live. I was fortunate to have you play at a private party. And I've been listening to you, and I know about your work, and as do other people. But in this particular album, was there any particular message that you wanted to convey through your music?
Well, the thread in this particular album, and there usually is a thread in each album. This one was kind of about traveling. You know, case in point, it was about traveling till it had a halt to that, but. The opening track is One Night in Madrid, and I didn't get to play in Madrid this year, but I did last April.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to play at the Maria Guerrero Theater in Madrid, and it was just amazing. The song Calling You that's on here, I wrote that about being on the road and, like, you know, being lonely, 20 miles to nowhere. You know, it's just like... Sometimes you're just traveling and it's like, you know, are we there yet kind of thing.
Yeah. And so you found it somewhat motivating for creating some music.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love writing and recording. That's probably my favorite thing to do. And I also love to travel. So getting to do all those things together is just right up my alley. I really like it.
How do you adjust to the fact that there's no audience right in front of you?
I've had to record a bunch of videos for jazz festivals. I had to play with tracks. I actually did one yesterday for Adam Hawley Live. It's going to be on his show sometime this month. So I have backing tracks or TV tracks from my recording. And since he's a guitar player, what we did was we took the guitar off and he's got a video of me playing my parts live, which he's going to put up on a screen, and he can play along with it on his show.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah. So where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's weird. You know, the one I did for the TEG Jazz Festival, I did four songs for them, and I sang and played flute and played saxophone, mixed up a few tunes from the new record. Mm-hmm. And it's, you just perform and just have to kind of like imagine that you do have no audience, even though you don't.
Yeah. But I think that, you know, there's so much discovery in the creative process. I mean, which is what I've observed, you know, my own personal creative process, but I have observed it in other musicians. So how did you get involved with jazz in particular? What drew you to jazz?
I heard some recordings of Ella Fitzgerald and Lamont Hurston Ross. And, you know, I started as a singer and I played some flute. So I was learning like scat solos and singing along with horn solos and writing words to them. And I take like a riff of Charlie Parker's and write it out in one key and then play it in every key. So, you know, I was doing all this kind of stuff and I was enjoying it, but I felt like I needed another instrument that had some more different colors than just flute. And so saxophone is in the woodwind family. A lot of the fingerings are similar or the same. So that was a really logical place to go.
It's interesting to me because I know that growing up, you know, saxophone wasn't an instrument that girls played. And I just remember them trying to shove the flute to me years ago. And I think maybe if they had given me a sax, I would have found an instrument that spoke to me. But somehow you superseded the stereotype. And here you are, the sexiest sax player on the planet.
Well, I did not pick flute first either. I wanted a piano when I was about five. And there's no musicians in my family, so my parents thought I was crazy, and they didn't really have money for it. So they didn't get that. And then when I was in school, in band, they said, what instrument you want to play? I said, how about drums? They're like, nah.
They asked you and then they told you no.
Right, right. They're like, I said, how about drums? They're like, no, little girls don't really play drums. I'm like, why not? They're like, how about a flute? And I was like, I don't know. All right. You know,
it's like, okay.
Yeah. You know, it was that.
And then you evolved. How did you evolve into the sax?
Well, like we were speaking about before, I just, you know, I'd been studying jazz, singing and playing flute. And, you know, I'd been listening to some horn solos and hearing people like Charlie Parker and Cannonball Adderley play. I wanted to learn how to do that.
How old were you into Cannonball Adderley? I mean, that is like old school, even for old people.
Well, it's like when you study an instrument, you have to learn what everybody did on it, that anybody of note. And you have to start with the masters, especially if you're going to play jazz, you have to start with traditional jazz. And you have to start with, I mean, I sang with a lot of Billie Holiday recordings, Roy Eldridge. And like I spoke of before, Ella Fitzgerald, and you have to study. I mean, I've worked with some people that said, you know, I learned how to play by listening to Grover Washington. Grover Washington's great, but you got to go back and really learn about music from the people that really started the whole jazz thing, you know?
You sound like you're one of these kids that might have been conceived to jazz, but you're saying your family didn't play musical instruments.
No, they didn't. My mother loved Nat King Cole and used to play his recordings. So I was used to hearing that. And I don't know that she was playing his more jazz oriented recordings. Like he played piano and jazz trios. He was a jazz pianist as well as a great singer.
A lot of people don't know that about him.
Yeah. I can't say that I knew that. I'm sure some of his jazz recordings were played, but I have this very vivid memory of my next door neighbor who's also playing flute. And we used to try to play the recordings, like we put a song on that we liked to try to find the notes and stuff like that. So I was trying to improvise from early on. But I remember she called me up on the phone one day and she said, listen to this. And she, like, we knew how to play Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Yeah.
So she started playing like ba ba da ba 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 da ba ba ba, and I was like, whoa, what are you doing? What is that? She's like, I don't know, but isn't it cool? I'm like, yeah, it's amazing, you know. So she just started to like swing the melody like you would if you were playing like, you know, a swing tune, if you were playing a melody like that jazz. And it completely blew my mind.
So it helped you free your mind and just let yourself go. That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was just like a concept of like, oh, you could play a melody like ba 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 ba, or you could play it ba ba da ba 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 da, you know, and completely like change the same notes, but a different feeling, a different rhythm. And I just never thought of that. You know, I was like 8 or 9 years old or something.
8 or 9 years old. So it actually spoke to you back then. So you have jazz all up in you.
Yeah. I mean, I just, it's fascinating and it's endless. It's just endless.
It's interesting how it's like so simple. I always like to ask artists in general, like, what was it? And you can remember the exact moment when your friend put the groove on Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Yeah, it blew my mind, you know. And then as I was growing up, I some of the artists I mentioned to you and some of the guitar players that I was friends with, like, had a Pat Martino recording. And then I heard Wes Montgomery, who I also love. And then I found out that Pat Martino studied from Wes Montgomery. I was like, oh my God, that makes a lot of sense. There you go, you know.
So this stuff, it's interesting. This stuff just like really fed your whole psyche. I can tell the audience that when I first got introduced to you and your music, you were actually playing on the back deck of during a party for like the girls. You were just like took your saxophone out and you just like wailed. It was fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
It was so good. And I was totally impressed because I didn't know what to expect, but you definitely added flavor to the party.
Thank you.
You know, you really have played with some famous people, I understand, as well. I know you've played at the Blue Note in Manhattan, which is a coveted, you know, stage to be on. And you've played with some very interesting jazz musicians and a lot of different musicians in your travels. And interestingly, you've done a lot of traveling. Are you finding that you can connect to the people that you've worked with in the past via the internet now that you can't really go into a full-fledged venue? Because I've seen some interesting Zoom casts that people are doing.
Well, yeah, I've done some Zoom interviews or other platforms. I've done quite a few interviews since March, you know, and they're all different things. Sometimes they're video, sometimes they're just audio. I had a Skype interview with Michael Parlay this Sunday, which he was in Los Angeles, but he's from the UK, so it gets played on Solar Radio there. And I have actually two other interviews with the UK later this month. And I had one, I think it was last month, with Lagos, Nigeria in Africa.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, and it was funny because he was interviewing me and playing a bunch of tracks for my recording. And we were talking about the fact that the first single went to number one in the States. He said, oh, I should tell you that Can You Feel It was number one in Lagos, Nigeria also. It was?
Yeah, wow, that's very impressive. Where can people find your album? How can they listen to you, you know, during this time, considering no one can really come out as easily and hear you? How can they listen to your music, purchase your album or tracks from your album?
Well, it's on Amazon or Apple Music or any place you like to buy music. And I also have my own Pandora channel.
Oh, good.
I'm on Spotify, all the other, you know, Deezer, Tidal, any place you search, my music will come out.
And so they just put your name in the search engine, wherever it is, Paula Atherton, just like it sounds, and you'll just pop right up. At least that was my experience, Paula, Googling you.
Yeah, yeah, that should work.
Yeah, no, it should work. And so they can hear you on iTunes, you said?
Yeah, iTunes changed into Apple Music.
Spotify, that's my favorite. And you have your own Pandora channel.
Yes, Pandora is very interesting because they'll play my music, but then they play other artists on my channel that are similar.
Right. They kind of vibe it together. They do that on Spotify. People that are listening probably know, but if they don't know, it's good to know that on Spotify, you'll actually hear this podcast on Spotify as well. You know, so I think it's good to know that if you put in a certain type of music that you like, they'll actually blend it with other music, with other musicians that sort of vibe the same way the music that you thought you wanted to listen to. But, you know, definitely Paula Atherton, you'll find that you won't be disappointed. I'll tell the audience that if you listen to her on Spotify or any of these platforms. And you have a website as well, I imagine. I know you do. How could they just go to, where do they go to, paulaatherton.com?
Yes, I'm updating some stuff on there now. I have to confess, I was kind of lax on that during COVID. I always put stuff on Facebook, which you could find me on Facebook. I have a fan page and a regular page. And Instagram, Paula Atherton Music on Instagram. And Twitter, I'm Patherton1 on Twitter.
LinkedIn. Most people don't think to go there, but go there. You'd be surprised who you find in the music industry on LinkedIn, any of the arts. A lot, you know, that's just like one of my little things, causes to let artists realize that we are sole proprietors and we belong on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn should really up their game a little to serve artists. It's so corporate that it doesn't.
Well, I got to tell you, you can go on LinkedIn Live. There's a lot of LinkedIn Live happening. LinkedIn actually, at this point, caters to artists. You know, that's been my experience. And LinkedIn Live is a way you can actually go and listen to live things and actually upload and perform on LinkedIn Live, just like Facebook, but you're reaching a different audience of people that can actually purchase what you have to offer. There's not a lot of fluff. And so they take the artist very seriously. I know that I found Paula on LinkedIn as well as Facebook. Instagram is another one. To me, that's Facebook. Are you on Twitter as well?
Yes, Patherton1 on Twitter.
Patherton1 on Twitter, or it's at Patherton1. So, you know, find Paula. I think that people will be like so fascinated by what you do. They obviously are because you're all over the internet anyway. And what's next for you?
Well, I'm going to start writing and recording again for the next project. We're working on some dates for next year. I have a few things booked. I was supposed to open for David Sanborn at the Norfolk Waterfront Jazz Festival this August. Of course, that got canceled, and I was playing it with my friend Cindy Bradley. We have a group called the Fabulous Blondes.
Oh, okay. The Fabulous Blondes.
Fabulous Blondes. She plays trumpet, and we're good friends, and we love playing together. And so we play some of her music, some of mine, and she's on a bunch of my recordings, and I'm on some of hers. Anyway, so that's going to come up in August, and we're playing the Pensacola Jazz Festival in September also. But in January, I'm supposed to be in the last weekend, January 2021, the last weekend I'm supposed to be in North and South Carolina if the quarantine gets lifted, you know. I have a lot of things kind of slated in, but we're following what's going on.
Yeah, you always have to have the plan B, and the plan B is basically whatever restrictions they're going to put down. But you've been doing very well to keep yourself like in the limelight in spite of this. It's impressive, I have to say. You know, I'm impressed with the fact that a lot of artists, some artists have become kind of immobilized by this, but then there are the artists like you, you know, and there are others of us that pick ourselves up by our own bootstraps and move forward. You got to reinvent yourself in some way, shape, or form. I would really love for the audience to listen to and be able to hear you play, because it's really a gift to hear you play. I think that jazz is one of those things. I mean, I'll say I'm partial to jazz, but I find that it's really a way to express what's going on the inside. There's something about the saxophone in particular that almost sounds like a voice talking to you, a little different from other instruments. And you really sort of put a lot of emotion into it. But I think that's par for the course for a musician in general. You know, so are you already planning your next album at this point?
Well, like I said, my favorite thing is to write and record. So since this album got completed, it just came out September 18th, just got pressed and went to Amazon and all the outlets September 18th. So I haven't really been recording since for the past couple of months because this got finished. So now I'm ready to go back again because I have a need to continue to write and record and just keep doing the whole thing over and over again. Maybe that sounds crazy, but
No, it sounds appropriate.
I don't like to not be able to play any of my instruments or sing or write or record. If I'm away from any of those things for a long period of time, it affects me. So I just keep trying to go to the next step and see what that's going to be and change up what I do a little bit and see where that takes me.
And it sounds like you're really always doing it. I imagine there's a lot of music that plays in your household in general. It's good that you keep doing these things. I'm really glad that I did this interview with you because I'm sort of feeling a different side of you that I didn't know. The part of you that's really serious about your work. I think that what happens to a lot of artists in general is they were misunderstood, and that people that are not involved in the arts or not artistic or just are enjoying it as end users of our product, they don't realize how serious artists are about our work. And it's hard during this time with the coronavirus happening and to feel sort of it's easy to get immobilized, but it takes a lot within a person, within an artist, to be able to galvanize and say, yeah, I'm going to keep creating, even though there might not be an audience right now, but you're making it happen. And it sounds like you're finding the audience by what you're doing in spite of the lockdown.
Yeah, well, one of the things I did besides the things that we spoke of already, I did a bunch of jazz workshops via Zoom or Google Meet or whatever. So I did 8 of them in July for the New Brunswick Jazz Festival Foundation. They're called Hub City Jazz Foundation. I'm on the board there. And I've done the festival, I think, 4 times. So they contacted me to do some jazz workshops this July. So I did, like I said, 8 for them. And I did 1 for this foundation that I'm also on the board of, F2F Foundation in Houston. And that one was really nice. So I love teaching kids how to play and just talking about improvising. And I represent Dakota Saxophone and I do some workshops for them. So that's really fun. With the F2F Foundation, we're actually working on, we work on getting students instruments for needy students. You know, if their family can't afford it and they really want to play. And there's a situation with that particular foundation where this one student who happens to be an autistic boy has told his family he really wants to learn trombone and the family can't afford one. So the president of the organization became aware of it. And we did a conference call between Dakota Saxophone, who also makes trumpets and trombones, their old arm of their company. And it looks like we're going to be able to get a trombone for this student.
Oh, wow. Good for you. Bravo for that one. You know, it's good you have to give back. You realize sometimes you think you have a problem. And then I can't imagine being a musician or even any kind of artist and not having my tools to create my art. And I think it's really excellent that you're helping children this way.
Oh, yeah. It's so important. I mean, music education in this country is like the first thing that gets cut from a curriculum.
Yeah.
A lot of teachers lost their jobs because of COVID. A lot of band directors. Only 1 or 2 that I know didn't. The other ones lost their jobs. So in other countries, like if you go to Europe, they would never cut the arts from a curriculum.
Well, I don't understand why we've always been that way. This is nothing new. I hate to say it, but we've always kind of been that way, I want to say, in this culture, I'll say. It seems that when things really go wrong, when a business person does the right thing and the smart thing, they call upon the artist, not 86 the artist. But I think eventually people will catch up to the way it would really work best for all concerned, but it's frustrating.
It's so important for kids growing up, music education, because it teaches them discipline. It gives them confidence. It helps them learn something that they can feel passionate about instead of getting involved in something really bad, you know, that their attention can turn to if they're bored or, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It needs to be there. It needs to be there. And, I've seen it happen with kids. I did a bunch of workshops for the Legacy Jazz Foundation of Virginia last November. And I was in this one class, and a lot of times the girls are the ones that are the most afraid. This one girl, like, had her instrument under the chair. She wouldn't even take it out of the case for the whole class. So I was teaching them about the blues scale and how you can use the blues scale to play over the blues. And I had some backing tracks. So I was playing the tracks, and I was showing them how you could do it with just, like, a couple of notes. And you just put feeling into it. And so they were checking it out, and I was trying to get a couple of the students to try it, and everybody's scared, right?
Oh, wow.
I don't want to go first. I don't want to do that. So this one boy that had a trumpet, I came up to him. I said, you know, come on. I'm just playing like ba 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 da ba 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 ba, just using a couple of notes and just being rhythmic with it. And he was like looking at me like, no, no, no. And then all of a sudden he picks his trumpet up. And he starts doing it. He starts bopping up and down to the music.
Wow.
And I'm playing like 4 measures and then he plays. And then it gets to the point where he's actually hearing what I'm playing and playing it back to me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
what you do when you improvise, you're kind of like having a conversation. So I say something and you pick up on what I said, just like what people do when they talk, and then you add to it. And then I talk about it and I add to it. So this was like going on and the whole track. And by the time the thing ended, it was like the whole class stood up and clapped for him.
Wow. See that? And at first he was afraid. So somehow he found it in himself not to be afraid, or you were able to draw him out. It takes a special, not everybody can do that with someone, you know. It's sometimes some people are very difficult to draw out, learners, I'll say. But yeah, that's got to be so satisfying to you. I can only imagine.
You know, first of all, that the student went home and told his family about it. And that totally changed everything for him. Just think about how that changed him, his confidence, how he feels about himself, what he thinks he can do. Oh, you know, I thought I couldn't do that, but I was pretty good at it. So what else can I do?
Sometimes it's hard to improvise. Not everybody can improvise. You got to really find it within yourself, or help someone will help you find it within yourself to just be yourself, be your artistic self. Don't be afraid.
It doesn't even have to be about improvising. That feeling carries through life. Oh, I just did something that I thought I couldn't do. Well, what else can I do?
Yeah. See what you did? See what you did, Paula? You know, you really did something beautiful, Paula.
It's what music does. It's what music does. And I was at the party later, the end party for the festival. And the woman that owns the festival, her and her husband own it. And she was watching something on her phone. And I overheard it. And I said, well, what are you watching? She goes, I'm watching your workshop. I said, you are? She said, yeah, the one you did today with the trumpet player when he was playing. I said, oh, let me see it. And to be able to like watch the video of it is different than being there, you know?
Yes.
So I was watching. I was like, holy, you know, holy guacamole, holy guacamole. I couldn't, you know, just to watch it, I was like, wow, that was cool. And I was so happy for him, you know, that he stuck his neck out a little bit and he did it. And it's all the students in the class saw him do it. And he was so proud of himself. And
that's one of those moments that he'll carry with him through his life.
He'll never forget that. He'll never forget that.
He'll never forget it. You know, he'll always remember that you were the one, too. I have to say, you're amazing, Paula. I learned things I didn't know about you. But I think that this is wonderful. I want to have you back on, and eventually we've been talking about doing like a talk with TQ with you, or maybe even a Zoom talk with TQ with you, because I think it'd really be interesting for the audience to be able to see you and to watch you, hear you play. Even the podcast is really great, but I'm going to let my audience look forward to that, because I know that it will happen. I want people to definitely go to your website, paulaatherton.com. Also look up your album, okay, which is...
Can You Feel It?
Can You Feel It? Can You Feel It? You know, so I want you to go and look that up for Paula Atherton, and she will be back. This is not the last you've heard of her. She's really outstanding. And I really appreciate you coming on the show, Paula. Fantastic.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It was really fun. Thanks for having me.
And we want to have you again, because there are other platforms that we actually do this show on. I'm just going to say good night to the audience, and thanks for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe. And come back again next time. There's always somebody interesting. And thanking Paula Atherton for being on again. And I'll see you next time. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe.